And tomorrow morning, the order of the lectures will be Lisher and then Garcia. Well, we are ready for our second session with Ismael Garcia. You're going to watch him carefully. He's going to bound on the stage with enthusiasm because he made it to Holden Lake this afternoon. And I think he needs a hand for that. And I told him, don't you dare fall asleep in front of this crowd. Ismael.
It is indeed true that there's nothing but good memory. Thank you very much for the invitation. I am a little bit angry about it, however. I was really intending to be controversial in my presentations, and it's very difficult. Very, very difficult to be controversial in such a setting. In my first presentations, I told you, I asked you something which is very true. I have a lot of bad habits speaking. Please help me with those. When I move away from the microphone, tell me, because I forget. You see, I never went to seminary, and we didn't have a professor of homiletics. And the local hospital didn't have one either. So it was a problem for me. I'm culturally deprived in certain areas, and this is one of them. So please, if I move away or you don't hear me, it's important for me that you hear me, not only because I want to share with you what I brought, but also because I need your response. So please help me, as if I move away, and if this goes too high, somebody told me to push this down, help me with that. What? Like this? Okay, thank you. I was sharing with Rich at dinner time, and deep pain in my right leg after the walk, that I was really caught by his the way he articulated the importance of stories in preaching. And I was sharing with him that it appeared to me that stories also have a powerful, powerful influence in processes of social change at two levels. One of them is the stories of the heroes that are in the process of striving for change. And that's the kind of story that motivates you to activity and keeps you in faith, especially when things look bad. You retell the stories of those that have been struggling for 200-300 years, and that, you know, it will happen. We will win, it's time, so on and so forth. And the other one is stories that happen after the victory. Or, you never get a victory in this, really, after you conquer power and society has been disintegrated and people have suffered, everyone has suffered, oppressed and oppressors alike. And there is a sense in which you have to retell a new story to put them all back together again, talking to one another. I was really captivated by that, and I wanted to share with you because it might be a topic of conversation tonight, if you so desire. What could be the possible uses of stories, politically speaking, outside of the life of the church, outside of the uses of sermon? I also wanted to initiate my conversation today by responding to some of the questions I was asked yesterday, and I'll do this briefly. But I need your help in one of them, and I'm assuming that there are enough ministers here that can help me with this. Why is it that God chose Israel? I mean, you know, it's not fair. Why is it that God chose Israel? Huh?
Because he wanted to.
Somebody else has?
Now, I have the Jewish explanation. I'm sure that you others have heard it as well. God offered the state of being with nations, other nations as well, but all the others refused. Said, okay, and that's the way I came about.
That really is not Lutheran, is it? So it's interesting because I'm kind of partial to the idea that it's an arbitrary choice. You don't really know, but as you know, you just start with something. So you choose Israel. It's not because they deserve it, and it's not an easy task they were given. But for what did God chose Israel?
Serving.
Serving. There's a sense for that. Serving all the nations. For the service of all the nations. Now, I want to say that because in liberation theology, in our simple faith, when we speak of God choosing and dwelling among the poor, it's not an excluding choice. God chooses the poor to serve all the nations. Now, I want to add to that a second element of the anxiety sometimes when I speak to North American crowds. One of it is, you know, I'm not poor, so God choosing against me. No, it's not that. Poor are chosen for maybe the same reason Israel is chosen, to serve all the nations. The particular is chosen for the sake of the whole. Okay? Now, the other one that came out a couple of times, but you know what are the poor responsible? I mean, what's their responsibility? These people sometimes just sit around and do nothing. Well, I spoke a little bit about that by the internalization of the process of oppression in which you become fatalist and passive and so on. That's one of it. Maybe Rick can help us in that. I mean, he wrote a dissertation in Marx, so he knows a lot of communist things down there. I really believed it, Marx never gave us anything interesting when he spoke about religion. I think he didn't care about the whole thing to begin with. So what he did was he repeated Feuerbach and didn't add much to that, kind of stayed there. And one of the interpretations is that religion was a political tool by the powerful to keep the poor in their place. And it served that role of stabilizing society and helping the benefits of the poor. I'm sure most of you have heard the catchy phrase for that, the opium of the people and things like that. They cannot care for themselves. Those are significantly different things. Can we equally say that both are equally just? That we're speaking of the same thing? I think McIntyre's question is tremendously, tremendously important. Now, we saw yesterday that for liberation theologians, the key theological problem of our day, from their perspective, of course, is the sociopolitical and historical reality of massive human poverty. That's the main issue for them today. That's the theological issue for them today. And for us, the question will be, does our commitment to the confessions of the Lutheran Church become an obstacle to participating in that historical project? Or do they become a catalyst of participating in that historical project? Now, I take it that the social context of the Augsburg Confession and the core of early Lutheran understanding of justification and justice emerges from medieval Christendom, its later stages, a highly structured and hierarchical social order. It is a society that is homogeneous, in which people have close encounters in some sense of common good and a broad consensus in the values that should predominate within society. It is a society that believes that people are essentially unequal, and thus able and called to play different roles in the different stratas of society. The social structure is perceived as a given. It is natural. For the Catholics, that became the whole doctrine of natural law. For the Lutheran tradition, the orders of creation, or something like that. An order given by God. And one position within this order is determined by birth. You're a son or a daughter of a farmer, you'll be a farmer. Son or daughter of a prince, you'll be a prince or a princess. And it was agreed, that is, by birth one was fated, and it was agreed that it was proper for the few to control wealth and power, and for the many to be poor and powerless, and to have a dependency between them. It was okay, very few people complained. It is society that perceives order and law as the key to peace and justice. Laws simply seek to make public the order that must prevail in society so that everybody knows what's their place and what they have to do. Everybody had some understanding of their rights and privileges and their social station. Law and justice were not perceived as goals to be obtained. Rather, they were perceived as keeping the status quo as it is. And the way you kept the status quo was, what is the traditional way of doing things? So it's a backward-looking conception of justice. Very conservative conceptions of justice. Tradition tells us what the just is. And laws merely enforce tradition. And we are called to comply with tradition. So it's a backward-looking sense. Justice, thus, is a matter of preservation, not of reformation. Creative change was a matter of restating the order that was violated, the tradition, not exploring new possibilities. Now, the closeness and homogeneity, is that the way you say that in English? Homogeneous, homogeneity? The closeness and homogeneity of the social order made it possible to have a clear sense of the common good, as well as a sense of mutual accountability. Now, many of you, when Jill this morning said, well, you sacrifice individual for the common good, and certain people went, ah. And they would say, of course. Of course. There's no aha involved. Of course. Logical. And the dynamic of dependence between the different social classes was such that it created almost a family environment. This relationship was very important, of closeness, because among one of the obligations of the powerful and the wealthy, one of the obligations of the office of the prince was to care and provide for the weak and the powerful when they were not able, for no reason of their own, to provide by themselves, and when providing would not threaten the social order. So there was a clear sense of dependence, and it was a paternalistic relationship in which the father and mother figure assumed responsibility for those that were perceived as powerless and wealthy. It was part of the mission of the church to see to it that this obligation of the princes be fulfilled, because this obligation was central to what it meant to be a noble. Theologically, therefore, this right of subsistence, and this is what is called in the literature, the right of subsistence, was based in the sense that creation was for the well-being of all creatures. A sense in which access and use to social goods had priority over ownership, appropriation, and property. This, I take it, is the social context and value structure within which the Reformed tradition was born. It was the social milieu of Lutheran Reformation. It was a milieu that had a lot of respect for political authority. And this acceptance of respect for political authority that I think Jill was emphasizing today was one of the reasons why I understand Luther as strictly a church reformer. The reformation of the church was the beginning and the end of his interest and of his reform efforts. And this inner nature of church reform, reform within the church, implied a lack of concern with social reformation. I take it, and this is some of the things I want to dialogue with you, that one of the distinctions between the Lutheran tradition and the Calvinist tradition, especially later Calvinist tradition, that was that for the Calvinists, church reformation became a rehearsal for political reformation. And I think that's one of the distinctions that we still carry to our day, maybe. For the Lutheran movement, the gospel did not challenge the social structure necessarily. It was not really concerned with justice. The gospel message is not a message mainly of justice. It's a message of salvation. Do you remember the Zacchaeus story? That's a little fellow that got up and talked to Jesus, and Jesus invited him to have a talk with him. Nobody knows what they talked about, but when they came out, Zacchaeus apparently was inspired and said, well, you know, I'll give away half of what I have to the poor. I'll do that to start with. And I'll give four times the amount of whatever I took away unjustly from somebody else. And I'm going to do this and that. And at the end, what does Jesus say? Ah, the justice of the Lord is upon you now. Salvation now dwells in your home. Did you want salvation? He opened himself to be part of the people again, and salvation will dwell in your home. Luther had an understanding of that the New Testament provides us very few resources for justice issues. Now, I don't know what you preach in your churches, of course. I haven't been able to visit all of those. But I have never heard a preacher preach of the justice of Jesus outside of the prophets. To ground his or her dependence on God. They were free to adapt to a social order, because they were free to respond directly to the call of God. In fact, preserving the social order by an act of self-sacrifice was seen as proper witness. On the other hand, since Luther had a strong sense of office, you know, I always liked Luther's conception that when ministers speak, they should put on the mask of God. It's a very powerful sense of the responsibility of your office. When you get up there and speak in my name, you have to change the mask. You speak in my name. Since he had a strong conception of the offices, the princes had an absolute obligation of caring for the worst off in society. The worst off in society could not claim that right. In fact, they should sacrifice. But it was the prince's obligation to see to it that their rights be given. You know, it pacifies their dependence a little bit more. I was a one-sided dependent. Now, this newfound Christian freedom, I'm arguing, is individual and inward. Liberation in this perspective is really a strictly religious, transcendent liberation, and transcendent to the historical, and somewhat unconcerned with social and economic and political issues. Political and social issues were the concern, the strict concerns of the professional politicians. The poor should not meddle in those affairs. Now, as does happen in history, even those who want to remain strictly religious and who do not want to have political role never remain marginal to political life. Ideas in general, and religious ideas in particular, do have social consequences. While one cannot argue that the Reformation led to capitalism and its formation, I think one could make a softer argument that there is an affinity within the ethics given in the Reformation and that developing capitalism. Now, with the emergence of capitalism and the Enlightenment, and this is the second stage in which I see Lutheranism developing their political understandings, with the emergence of capitalism and the Enlightenment, a new form of consciousness and social order was beginning to consolidate itself, bringing with it new values and a new understanding of the way human relations should be organized. Tradition was undermined, heavily so, and a new sense of authority began to emerge. Increasingly, it became clear the human capacity to give themselves historical projects, to choose the kind of world they want to live in. The social order was no longer seen as given. It was seen as made. And there was no reason to adapt to it. We could transform it. Now, people saw themselves as equal in every significant moral respect. He could be taller, higher, fatter, thin, that didn't matter. In substantive moral respects, we are equal, radical equality. They were born free and never subject to the origin which they are born. Their rights now were not defined nor limited by their station in life, but were inherent in them as individuals. The individual begins to establish him herself as the basic unity of society. The autonomy Luther asserted in religious life, the Enlightenment expanded to every dimension of life. At every level of life, the individual should act according to his or her consciousness. The economic, the political, the social realms were now to serve the needs and wants of autonomous individuals. And if the social order did not serve these needs and wants, it gradually became legitimate for the individuals to transform it, to engage in social change. One was not encouraged to adapt, but to self-initiate, to make a historical mark, to gain uniqueness within history. Now, justice is redefined. Why, justice in the first sense meant act according to your station in life, perform the functions tradition has given in that station. Justice loses its content. In fact, justice doesn't have particular ends in mind. Becomes a formal definition. The issue is what was not to achieve a given end, but basically to establish procedures of acquisition and exchange, that if followed, people had what they were entitled to. The right of subsistence of the poor then, I mean, in this kind of society, everything gradually becomes impersonal. Nobody has to care for anyone else. Everybody cares for themselves. In fact, the vision was that I would join society if and only if I get out of it, at the minimum, what I put into it. Otherwise, I don't play the game. Good contract. I will engage in the social contract if and only if, at the minimum, I get what I put into it. And I'm hoping to get more. But at the minimum, if I'm sent, then I play. So the rights of the subsistence of the poor are left to the free workings of the market. If they can manage by themselves, that's it. No one has that obligation. There was no room for subsistence rights anymore. Rights and liberation now are defined mainly in terms of not interference, particularly not interference by the state. Was very important. The principal freedom was not necessarily the freedom of self-initiating action. The principal freedom was the freedom to dispose of one's property. I want to decide if I want to give it to my children in inheritance, if I want to give it to a cat, if I want to burn it, or give it to the church. That's the main freedom I want, to dispose of my property. Imbuing persons as autonomous individuals, there's very little sense of dependence. It is irrelevant where one stands in the social order as long as the opportunity of changing one's lot is there. Social relations then become basically utilitarian and external. Society is perceived as an extrinsic reality and instrumental. Social life no longer is good in itself. It is only good as far as it can provide the goods and services the individuals within them desire to carry out the life plans they choose themselves. The notion of the common good loses its meaning. There is no common good. There's certain general things like national security and general health and things like that. There is no sense of common good anymore, except the sum of the goods of all the individuals. Begin to see the tension, right? Medieval society had such a strong sense of common good that it coerced individuals to conformity to it. The liberal bourgeois society begins to develop such a sense of common good that makes the individual unaccountable. The passivity I'm arguing the Lutherans inherited from their commitment to the social order in the Middle Ages continues as capitalism develops. The workings of the new political and economic order does not become a church matter. It is again left to political leaders and business people. And only marginally does the church begin to emit certain political options here and there, but not as an integral part of their being as a church. And with or without intention, these pronouncements embody the value structure of the political order out of which they are made. It is my interpretation, and again, here I need to converse with you, that the main social documents of the Lutheran Church are an affirmation of liberal bourgeois society, almost as a matter of principle. It's an acceptance and accommodation to that society. As capitalism develops and its contradictions and limitations begin to emerge, and in particular after the Depression and Second World War, there emerges within the capitalist structure a new awareness of the importance of the rights of subsistence. This new awareness, of course, is the result of popular political movements which sought to democratize and politicize the economic sphere as well as the political one. Within the United States, for example, the New Deal and the Great Society programs are based on a suspicion of the free market's capacity to attend the needs of all the people. And thus, there is an openness and a recognition of the need of the state to intervene constructively, one hopes, in supplying the worse off within society with certain basic economic goods. It gradually became a justice option to actually contribute and support politically institutions whose business is to care for the poor. These struggles of the poor were an attempt to bridge the gap between the political and the economic. And that is what today, I'm trying to connect with some of Jill's. Jill was arguing some issues. When you think, for example, of the ideological intention of the Reagan administration, one of its main tenets is we have to minimize the welfare state. And the argument is a very interesting argument. It is inefficient. And we can do the same with less. I mean, that's the argument. We can do the same by pouring less money into it. Now, it's an interesting argument because it is a recognition of the limitation of classical liberal bourgeois political economy. The Reagan administration cannot argue politically, I will eliminate the welfare state, which is the real consequences of what they ought to stand for. The argument is, we will make it more efficient. Because politically speaking, once something is given, you can't take it back. You can't take it back. But then what you measure is what is the power of the groups that benefit, and when can I reduce and cut and do this and that? And what criteria do you use? And usually the programs that get cut are the ones of which people vote less. Those that benefit actually don't participate politically. So therefore, there's more possibility there. Okay? And the spirit of the nation and international things, so on and so forth. And that's our justice debate today. I mean, we owe to Reagan, not only to John Rawls, bringing back the question, well, what are the legitimate grounds under which the state ought to intervene or not intervene in taking away part of your money to give it to somebody else you never met, and you don't feel guilty because they don't have certain things? Reagan has brought that debate back to us. Now, today in the liberation movement, both within the United States and in Latin America and some other places, there is an attempt to understand justice no longer as abiding by tradition, kind of meritocratic notion of justice, nor a procedural notion of justice based on merit, on the market, and luck, and so on and so forth. You know, this market thing, there's a lot of luck related to it. Well, do you imagine what would happen to Moses if in his walk he went through a puddle of oil? He wouldn't be happy with that. Sticky, messy thing, ruining my sandals and so on and so forth. Has no social meaning, right? Takes a particular social moment in which somebody stands on oil and suddenly say, oh my God, look at this, I'm Texas. We're going to produce a lot out of this, okay? That's a social accident. Well, you would imagine what would happen to the inventor of the Frisbee if he did that in Egypt when the sphere was a sacred symbol. You can't go around throwing the sacred symbol in a bathing suit. You just can't do that. So there are historical accidents which account for certain things coming out okay and other things working, right? So the market had that kind of arbitrary. The liberation movements try very hard to curtail the social and historical accidents of the market. And they begin to think of justice as a corporate model of justice and liberation, as an alternative to the individualistic subjective model. The model makes a clear end option for the poor. The end is no longer, pluralism is not left there. Pluralism within the limits of serving the poor. And clear end is stated. Social order is just that. It's social order is valued in terms of justice or lack of justice by the way it treats the worst off members within society. Again, the affirmation of the poor. Justice now has to do not only with equality of opportunity, but some sense of equality of results. And it's not sameness. The issue is not that everybody has the same. I mean, I really don't want a yacht. I'm afraid of water. I don't want a yacht, and I don't want an airplane. I'm afraid of heights. I want books and other things that I'm more familiar with. So I don't mind if other people have more than I have in order to acquire those things. In the liberation perspective, what I do mind is that when we have a difference, that difference enables the other person to dictate to me how I can live. So it's not the inequality that I resent. It's the domination it brings. And we can find political solutions to that. Leave the inequality, but eliminate the domination. John Rawls, in his famous book, A Theory of Justice, came out in the 70s. I don't know if you read that. It's a very dry, philosophical, very passionate written book at the same time. Has a very interesting sense of fraternity. I always thought that if there's anything Christian in Rawls, is that. A sense of fraternity, in which each citizen develops the virtue of not wanting to take advantage at somebody else's expense. Now, you can't get more radical than that. That when I get more, it shouldn't be to somebody else's expense. In fact, I'm entitled to more only if I improve the well-being of those who are off. Something in the liberation model radicalized that, but it's someplace around it in their understanding of justice. The establishment of communal relationship becomes not an instrumental thing, but part of what it means to have a good life. So being in community itself is good. It's not an option, it's not a choice. It's a given one must cultivate proper human interrelationships. And people ought to begin to be perceived as good in themselves, not only as consumers and producers. The claim that justice receives its content by serving the interests of the poor undermines in principle our present social order, and that's why it is an in principle conflict-ridden conception of justice. It is inevitable that it will lead to confrontation, since it calls the wealthy not only and mainly to surrender their wealth, that they're willing to do when they're against the wall, but to surrender their power, the decision-making capacity, policy-making. Justice from the perspective of the poor and the marginal is grounded in the right of the poor as a social class, not as an individual, to their own self-interest. From their perspective, self-interest, you heard that, self-interest? From their perspective, this assertion of self-interest does not in principle betray working for the whole. In my understanding of North American Lutheran documents and some of the official statements, and I'm mainly banging here the LCA 1978 document on human rights and the 19A document on economic justice, there is a tremendous suspicion that the claim to self-interest can lead to liberation. These documents really reject that view. And if it did, it is suspect if that's the Christian way. If it is a legitimate way for the Christian community to get involved in the struggle. The documents tend to place all assertions of self-interest at the same level. The self-interest of the poor are as bad as the self-interest of the powerful. That's not the way you go about dealing with things. All forms of assertion of self-interest are equally expressions of human sin. Now, it's very interesting because in the Lutheran tradition, the condition of sinfulness is so overriding that there is a disregard of particular manifestations of sin. That's a problem. But I find it interesting that when Luther deals with the question of usury, is that the way you say that in English?
Usury.
He does not deal with sin in general. He deals with sin in a very particular, concrete social manifestation. But it's the only document with this in which that comes out. So the predominant conception within the Lutheran community is we are all sinners, and there is a sense in which it doesn't make a difference, ultimately, whether you live in this social order or that social order, in terms of your sinfulness. But think of the paralyzing effect it has socially and politically speaking when you criticize a concrete social reality in the same way you criticize a social possibility. You end up affirming what you have because you can't get rid of it. And you avoid the possibility of something new. Is it a matter of fact that the self-interest of the poor for having a good life is at the same level of the self-interest of the wealthy to continue in a position of domination and advantage? Are there significant differences between those? Are they equally sinful? Help me with that. Self-interest always leads to self-righteousness. True justice, therefore, is identified with some form of self-sacrifice or agape, understood as sacrificial love. From a liberation perspective, humanly and politically speaking, it is mutuality that is central, not sacrificial love. That's the difference right there. Justice is a matter of mutuality. Justice, among other things, is my constant standing in a response of mutuality, even when I don't get it. But it's not surrender of love. Within the documents, justice never results from the organization and concerted actions of group pressing the self-interest. Self-interest is always antagonic or antagonistic, I don't know where, which way you say that, to Christian love. And thus, in the end, unable to forward true justice. And if my interpretation of the document is correct, and it's just subject to debate, the justified self becomes a disembodied self, is self-understood apart and in abstraction from the social and economic and political conditions that define them as the kind of person he or she is. The individual and their religious inner being are the subject of transformation. Their personal behavior and witness is transformed, but their social world and historical world is left untouched, since ultimately it is religiously irrelevant to their salvation. Now, there are certain advantages in this Lutheran conception which I think we have to pay attention to. One of them is that it's a good way of avoiding sacralizing any historical project. At least that's part of the intention. Not giving divinity to a given particular order, making it an object of religion. But I wonder if it does so at the expense of under-evaluating human activity within history and the theological meaning of human activity. And I even wonder if it achieves the ends it wants to achieve. Because if we remove ourselves, if we remove the religious meaning from political life, what will give political life meaning? If we perpetuate a system, don't we make it into an idol and make it claim an eternity it is not entitled to? I wonder about that. If the religious community, which is a community that claims an experience of transcendence, does not participate politically, does it deprive the political and historical realm of a transcendent transformation? I don't know. But it is clear that in the Lutheran perspective, the penultimate is never confused with the ultimate. But sometimes it's deprived of its religious meaning. There is a split created in the self as a historical being and as a eschatological being. Lutherans deal with the poor and care for the poor, but do not touch the conditions that make them poor. Can we understand what a poor person is apart from the conditions that make it poor? And the question I leave for us today is it possible to have a legitimate Lutheran sense of social justification? Thank you.
Thank you, Ismael. Tough assignment when you're going in and out of power, but you ended on power. You really brought something for us to think seriously about. I hope you'll come to the fireside tonight at, 10 after 9? All right, let's start at 9. Try it at 9:30. I know you need to get your ice cream and so forth. I want to mention that tomorrow morning there will be no Eucharist at 7:30. Because we will have the evening Eucharist. Friday again at 7:30, but not tomorrow morning. Okay, I saw a hand, yes? Yes, please. Yes, I think you should.
I want to give everybody an opportunity to come to Alaska and take a tax-deducted trip. We're going to have one of the world-renowned theologians, Leslie Newbegin, in Anchorage, Alaska, on February 12th, 13th, and 14th. And we would invite you to come and participate. It's sponsored by the Alaska Christian Conference, our Ecumenical Association of Churches, the ALC and LCA in Alaska are both parts. I'm the president, and we would welcome you. Tom Kangas, who's a pastor of St. Mark's in downtown Anchorage, would be happy to talk with you about arranging space in some of his members' homes to help you there. I will be willing to send you more information if you're interested. That's February 12th, 13th, and 14th in Anchorage. Leslie Newbigin, one of the first bishops of the Church of South India. Many LCA will know him by a book just given to us, complimentary, or to several of us complimentary, Foolishness to the Greeks. His theme is, how can we present the gospel to a secular culture? And his time in India gives him a different perspective than we who have lived in the West. Thank you, Walter.
Thank you, Ashford.